Section 2. What is myth? There has been frequent debate over the genre of the Gospels and whether they are fundamentally myth or history. But myth is not really a literary genre in the standard sense, since it crosses all genres of literary composition. Plutarch's biography of Romulus is entirely myth, for example, yet written in the genre of historical biography. We noted this in Chapter 4 and in Element 47. Most attempts at identifying the genre of the Gospels consist of comparing it to other literary forms, but this has only resulted in either unresolved disagreement or classifying the Gospels as a unique genre of their own, which unhelpfully eliminates the opportunity to interpret them or assess their historical value by comparison with documents of similar genre. Even classifying the Gospels as biographies is unhelpful, as demonstrated by the example again of Plutarch's Life of Romulus. Even if the Gospels perfectly corresponded with the genre of ancient historical biography, that in itself would not indicate whether they were in fact historical or mythical. For in fact, a great deal of ancient biography, even of real people, was constructed of myth and fiction. Accordingly, our aim should not be identifying the genre of the Gospels, but the intent of their authors. Whatever literary form they chose or created, were they writing myth or history? There are countless definitions of myth employed in a variety of fields, and debate persists as to what exactly myth is, but such debates need not be resolved here. If someone claims the Gospels are myth, they can define myth any way they please, so long as they demonstrate the Gospels conform to that definition and then remain consistent with that definition when drawing conclusions. The major trend in the study of myth today is reflected and well surveyed by Radcliffe Edmonds in his own summary of myth scholarship and its main conclusions. In that school of thought, myth consists of factually untrue stories that are historically improbable but symbolically meaningful. Myths, in that sense, operate according to three basic rules. 1. A mythic story is a seemingly straightforward account of something that happened, yet its content and structure are carefully arranged to convey a deeper meaning than the superficial narrative might suggest. 2. This is accomplished using symbols familiar to the audience, keywords, ironies, allusions, double entendres, etc., relying on a known database of cultural, literary, religious, grammatical, and other facts. And 3. What an author of a myth changes is often the point of the myth. For example, if the story is highly allusive to another myth, yet reverses or radically alters certain elements of that myth, the allusions indicate what myth to compare the changes to, and the changes indicate how the author's message is meant to differ from the message of the earlier myth. In the words of Radcliffe Edmonds, quote, "Not only can an exploration of the various ways in which authors use a common set of elements uncover the different agendas of these authors and provide a deeper understanding of the individual texts, but it can also shed light on the ways in which myth was used as a device for communication, a mode of speaking in which they could convey meaning densely through the manipulation of mythic motifs and patterns that each had its own resonance for the audience," end quote. Very often this communicated message involved plans for reforming society, or proposing and defending models for how society or the world should function or do function. To this end, myths communicate the values and universal truths embraced by the author, which the author desires his audience to embrace in turn. As Edmonds puts it, quote, "The Greek poetic and mythic tradition provides the models of and models for the society, models which are given authoritative status as a description of the way the cosmos is constituted and of the proper modes of behavior within it. And their elements are symbols that enunciate a model with a general application. However, each myth, each telling of a traditional tale, presents a different variation of the model. As the teller shapes the narrative according to his perceptions of the cultural models, so the symbolic elements within the tradition are manipulated by the teller. And this symbolic system provides a language by which the myth teller may communicate with his audience. And as a result, every myth is shaped by its context and the motivations of its narrator," end quote. If the Gospels are myth in this sense, then we have a ready explanation for the considerable contradictions and changes in the Jesus story across the four canonical Gospels and other Gospels beyond, to which modern apologists respond with increasingly implausible ad hoc harmonizations, while historians respond with attempts to develop criteria to isolate the historical truth behind the conflicting accounts, a method that has consistently been found invalid. But if the Gospels are myth, then both efforts are futile, as both assume the intent of the authors is to record, if perhaps embellish, a collection of historical facts reported to them. If instead the intent of the authors is to construct symbolic myths about Jesus, then we have no reason to expect any of their content to be historical. Some of it may be, but since distinguishing fact from fiction would not have been of primary interest to the Gospel's authors, we will have little hope of finding clues to such distinctions in the texts themselves. We can work with external corroboratory evidence to isolate the factual elements, an ideal example being the archaeological and literary confirmation of the existence of Pontius Pilate. So, confirming the Gospels are myth would not in itself entail, for example, the conclusion that Jesus did not exist. But it would greatly alter and limit our ability to know the historical truth about Jesus, and would fundamentally change our focus in studying the content of the Gospels from an interest in extracting history from that content to an interest in ascertaining its mytho-symbolic meaning and intent. I'll have more to say about this in chapter 12. This is often easier to see outside the field of biblical studies, where blinding bias runs rampant. In the Iliad, for example, Homer depicts a boxing match between two young men named Epeius and Euryalus. Epeius boasts of being undefeatable in typical Homeric fashion, and then overwhelmingly defeats his opponent. Centuries later, in the Aeneid, Virgil mimicked this boxing match. But Virgil replaces Epeius and Euryalus with the Roman heroes Dares and Entellus, and changes its geographical location, its historical date, and even its outcome. Nevertheless, there are enough intentional similarities to confirm that updating Homer's tale was Virgil's intent, and the changes Virgil made, apart from the trivia of when, where, and who, become more meaningful when this emulation is recognized. In Virgil's account, instead of the boxers being two young men, Entellus is an old man who laments his lost youth. Then, the Homeric plot is reversed. Young Dares, the powerful braggart, does not win as his counterpart does in Homer. Instead, the old man, Entellus, although taking a fall just like his Homeric counterpart Euryalus, returns with a fury and overwhelmingly defeats his foe, who is described the same way Homer had described the defeated Euryalus, carried by his comrades and spitting out blood. Unlike the Homeric story, in Virgil's account, Entellus was driven to return to the fight by a sense of shame and valor, which were moral values emphasized in Roman culture. Virgil's story also reverses the Homeric glorification of youth and denigration of the elderly, again to reflect the more modern values of Virgil's time. The parallels break down like this. From Homer, the invincible youth Epeius becomes, in Virgil, the invincible youth Dares, both of whom boast of their great prowess. They each fight their opponent. From Homer, this is the youth Euryalus, who loses. In Virgil, he becomes the elder Entellus, who wins, even though in both stories they take a fall. So we have numerous deliberate parallels and a couple of key and significant reversals. Thus, Virgil has told the same story as Homer, but he has recast the characters into a different historical setting and changed the plot in order to reflect and communicate how Roman values differ from Homeric values. This was a common practice. How you changed a myth was a way of communicating how your message differed from the earlier myth. Thus, when we find parallels in a later myth with an earlier myth, the way those two myths differ from each other is often the author's reason for borrowing from the earlier myth in the first place. What the new author leaves out, what he adds, what he changes, is all the point of the story, and is what we need to look at in order to understand what the author is saying. Virgil was certainly not saying that Homer got the historical context wrong, that the boxing match really took place at a different time and place between different people. Nor was Virgil saying that Homer incorrectly reported the historical outcome of the boxing match. It's doubtful either Homer or Virgil believed this boxing match actually happened, even though they both place the match in history and record it in a straightforward narrative that looks no different from any poetic record of witness testimony. Instead, Virgil is retelling this event in order to symbolically communicate his different values. What matters to him is not whether this boxing match occurred. What matters to him are the underlying values and message the story conveys. We thus don't gain any understanding if we try to harmonize these contradictory tales or to ascertain what actual historical event inspired them, even if any did. We gain understanding only by recognizing the parallels and changes intended by Virgil, and the significance of the resulting symbolism of the story's structure and content. Virgil's Aeneid is full of such transvaluations of Homer, rewriting Homeric narratives with Roman characters and values. For example, as Dennis MacDonald notes, quote, Virgil imitated the death of Hector in Homer's Iliad when composing his account of the death of Turnus, end quote. What the story means is all we can study, and all we should study, not whether it actually happened. Only rarely are we able to do more. It is therefore crucially important to determine whether the Gospels are myth. This cannot be achieved by identifying their genre, because myth exists in all genres. It can be achieved only by confirming whether they contain narratives that conform more to the definition of myth than of history. Are the central narratives of the Gospels historically improbable but symbolically meaningful? Is this meaning concealed by a superficially historical narrative that is highly allusive to other myths, texts, or concepts that increase both the interpretability and likelihood of the content of that narrative more than a supposition of history would? And is this evident in both parallels to and the conspicuous deviations from those targets of allusion? In short, is the content of those narratives more likely on the theory that they are myth or on the theory that they are history? Characteristics of myth are 1. Strong and meaningful emulation of prior myths or even of real events. 2. The presence of historical improbabilities, which are not limited to miracles, but can include natural events that are very improbable, like amazing coincidences or unrealistic behavior. And 3. The absence of external corroboration of key rather than peripheral elements. Because a myth can incorporate real people and places, but the central character or event will still be fictional. No one of these criteria is sufficient to identify a narrative as mythical, but the presence of all three is conclusive, and the presence of one or two can also be sufficient when sufficiently telling. We must avoid parallelomania, of course, the error of finding patterns everywhere by relaxing what counts as a parallel, or finding parallels that have no identifiable reason to be present. Avoiding that requires focusing only on features that, altogether, are very improbable on any other explanation. Thus, chance correlations can be distinguished from genuine signatures of mythosymbolic composition. This does mean we might have to set aside correlations that might be mythosymbolic but cannot be proven to be. But that does not mean concluding they are not mythosymbolic, only that we cannot be certain that they are. Meanwhile, in many cases, we can be reasonably certain. And if we find enough of those in a single text, this supports the conclusion that the remainder are as well, according to the principle of contamination, which Stephen Law has formally articulated for miracle content in the April 2011 issue of Faith and Philosophy. His argument can be fully extended to all improbabilities, including emulative features of a story that are improbable coincidences if posited as history, but not improbable as an authorial creation. In Bayesian terms and with respect to the Gospels, what we are looking for in each pericope, each internally complete narrative unit within a Gospel, are features that are improbable as history but probable as myth. More precisely, that means features that have a lower consequent probability on history than they have on myth. Not in respect to Jesus being a myth, but just in respect to the pericope itself being a myth. If we start with no assumptions and thus assign a prior probability of 0.5 or 50% for history in this sense, and thus also 0.5 or 50% for myth, in other words, we are assuming both are equally probable at the outset, and then if we count the whole content of a pericope as E, or evidence, and treat H as history and not H as myth, and then we find that the probability of E given H is less than the probability of E given not H, the result will be that the probability of H given E will be less than 0.5, in other words, less than 50%. And that means the prior, the probability of H, that we use to determine the next pericope will be less than 0.5. If we find that the probability of E given H is less than the probability of E given not H for that pericope too, then the probability of H falls even further, and so on. If for any pericope, the probability of E given H equals the probability of E given not H, it then has no effect. But if the probability of E given H is greater than the probability of E given not H for any pericope, then that can start to restore credibility by raising the probability of H given E for that pericope and thus raising the probability of H for the next or remaining pericopes. However, if that never happens, or rarely happens, or happens only too weakly, then the cumulative effect of the other pericopes will be a substantially reduced prior probability that any pericope is historical rather than mythical. In short, if there are many clear instances of myth-making in a gospel, and no clear instances of the contrary, then the remainder of that gospel must be assumed to be more probably than not mythical, even if we can't prove it in any of those remaining cases. The effect of this on historicity will not be to establish that Jesus didn't exist, but to eliminate evidence for his existence. That technically does mean it raises the probability of the non-existence of Jesus, but only by the amount that that probability would have been lowered by the Gospels being historical accounts of him. The net effect is simply the removal of the Gospels as evidence, as Burton Mack has already argued we should do. We already know as a general rule that completely fictional accounts can be written about historical persons, and seemingly straightforward historical accounts can be written about non-historical persons. So which it is, whether the Gospels are fictions about a historical person or fictions about a non-historical person, will have to depend on what the remaining evidence indicates, that of the epistles, for example, to be examined in the next chapter, or that of the other evidence already examined in chapters 8 and 9. There is one important exception to this point. The Rank Raglan data, which was used to construct our prior probability in chapter 6, because it can be correlated with enough examples to derive an actual probability that such data would accumulate for a real man. But we have already employed that evidence in our calculation, and only if we didn't would we introduce it here. Revisit chapter 6 on this, but also I'll cover it again in chapter 12. Thus, the mythic character of the Gospels overall will affect our estimate of historicity, but only as much as it already has.